Well, thanks for the opportunity to be here, and I want to compliment you. As I understand, this is a senior support group, and I deal with a lot of folks who have gone through various aspects of aging and end-of-life situations. And, of course, everyone tells me, you know, I learned so much. Well, they typically learn by trial and error, which is a painful way to learn. And I've encouraged some of these folks that they ought to write a book, because some of these things, there is a better way than to learn these things trial by error. Now, the piece that I'm going to talk about is powers of attorney, and that's a fairly straightforward thing, and you can find out about powers of attorney on the internet, and that's not so big issue. But there are some other issues, like how we die. You know, medical science has changed the way we die. And, you know, a lot of us haven't really accepted that or really come to understand what the dying process is nowadays, and what we actually die of. Now, if you've worked through this with your parents, then you probably know. But it's changed even in the last 10 or 15 years. And so that's another topic, and that's other things that we learn. The power of attorney is a disability planning document. It's to address the situation where the principal, the person who signs the power of attorney, is unable to act for themselves. Now, I used to think that one day you were in full command of your faculties, and then another day you weren't, and that this typically happened by a stroke or something like that. I've come to know that that's not the way it works in most cases. Certainly there are some people who suffer a stroke, and as a result of that, they lose some of their capacity. But even in a stroke victim, it's not an all or nothing. What typically happens is you start losing some of your ability to make complicated decisions. You know, decisions that have multi facets. And you start to lose that, and often it's very slow. And I've seen people who still regularly attend church, they're doing business, they're going to meetings, but then once in a while they'll make a really bad decision. And you say, where'd that come from? Well, it came from the aging process. Their ability to process information, particularly new situations, it diminishes over time. Now, that's bad news in some respects, because it would be nice if we just knew, oh, today I can't do this, or today mom can't do this, or today my spouse can't do this, and now I know that I have to do this. It usually doesn't work that way. You just see situations where a person who's older starts to make poor decisions, just once in a while. I mean, it's very inconsistent. One of the things about a power of attorney is, when does it become effective? Well, if you look at this power of attorney that I've handed out, which is typical, if you look back at page 5, section 7, that says effective date and duration. And unlike a lot of powers of attorney, this one says very specifically, this power of attorney is effective immediately. So that means the moment you sign it, your agent can start acting for you. Now, a critical piece of our understanding is that when you sign a power of attorney, you are not signing away your rights. You can continue to do all the things that you ever could do. What you're actually doing is appointing someone else who can act for you. Now, typically, the understanding is that they will do that when you're incapable of handling your affairs. But the power of attorney, this one says that it's effective immediately. Now, why is it effective immediately? Well, for two reasons. One is that if you put a condition in this power of attorney, and you can do that now, we didn't It used to be that we couldn't do that, but we can do it now. We can say that this power of attorney, this agent's power to act for me, will begin when I am unable to handle my affairs. You can say that when they get a doctor's certification that I am unable to handle my affairs. You can do whatever you want to do. The problem is that if you put a condition in the document, some financial institutions will not honor the document. They will not honor conditional powers of attorney. Now, that's not true for most of the people we deal with. But to give you an example, if you have investments with an investment advisor, one of the companies that some investment advisors use as sort of what they call the back office, the custodian to hold the funds, is a company called Pershing, just like General Pershing of World War I fame. Pershing will not honor a conditional power of attorney. Now, Virginia law was changed in 2009 to specifically penalize financial institutions that don't honor a power of attorney. If they don't have a good reason, then they can be required to pay the attorney's fees. Pershing says, we are a New York corporation. We're not subject to Virginia law, and therefore we can basically thumb our nose at you. And that's what they do. So that's one reason why you may not want to have a condition like saying that this is effective when I become disabled. The second reason is just what I was talking about earlier. You may be totally able to handle your routine affairs, pay your bills, go to the grocery store, write your check to the church, etc., but not really capable of doing some other decisions. And nobody really knows when that time is. And that's a difficult issue. But if you have a document that says that's when it's only effective when I'm incapable of handling my affairs, that can be a real problem. Because, I mean, my mother has dementia. And for years, she would go to the doctor and, you know, the report always came back, she's fine. Well, you know how hard it is to talk to doctors. Well, finally, I left a voicemail on the doctor's and said, test my mother. She really cannot remember things. So for some reason, I mean, that I don't know why they hadn't done it before, but in that case, they tested her and found out that, yes, her short-term memory was very deficient. So you have these issues that sometimes it's easy to say that, well, you know, she's not really capable of handling her affairs because she can't remember things. But cognitively, she could understand. You know, her difficulty at that point was she couldn't remember the facts she needed to know in order to make the decision. But if she could understand, she was still very intelligent. She could carry on a conversation. She could make decisions if she could remember what it was that she needed to remember. And so this area of when are you incapable of handling your affairs is a difficult one. Now, it causes problems in another way. Many people, probably most people, appoint their children as their agent. In this case, you see that Alexander Mack has appointed his wife, Belinda, and his son, Marcus. And I put in here, see where Marcus lives? He's of Mack's Meadows. Now, does anybody know where Mack's Meadows is?
Southwest of here,
up near Radford area. Well, the Max of Mack's Meadow is Alexander Mack's son. He actually moved to that area from Pennsylvania and lived there for several years until he thought the Indians were getting too dangerous. So it was obviously not spelled M-A-X, though it became to be spelled that. So now that's a useful tidbit All the rest of this stuff is just fluff. So in this case, Alexander Mack points his wife and his son. And if you look at section 2, it says, if my agent resigns, dies, becomes incapacitated, or declines to serve, I name Teresa Mack. Now, Teresa stayed back up in Germantown, and she's the successor agent. Now, one of the things you notice there is that if clause. If. Another thing that in most cases, or many cases, if you're married, you typically want your wife to be a primary agent and your children to be the secondary agent. It's not that you don't trust them, it's you don't want to tempt them. I'll say that again. It's not that you don't trust your children, it's you don't want to tempt them into taking over your affairs when you're still capable of handling it. Well, going back to this, this is a condition. Pershing would not honor Teresa Mack. They would not treat her as a valid agent because that's a condition. Okay? So another thing that we often do is like we've done up above, even though Alexander Mack would want his wife Belinda to handle his affairs, we've named the son Marcus as a co-agent. And in the next line it says, independent of the each with full authority independent of the other. And that means that they don't have to sign together. That means Belinda could write a check or Marcus could write a check. It's important to have more than one agent. If he only named Belinda and Belinda either died or became incapacitated, he wouldn't have an agent. The document becomes useless at that point. But what we typically recommend, if you're comfortable, is name whoever you might want to serve as co-agents rather than primary and alternates. Okay? Now, but having named Marcus, there's a greater chance that Marcus may decide, Dad really doesn't know what he's doing. You know, he started writing all these checks to all these charities and all these political things. I have enough older people in my family, and they typically get mail about this thick every day because they started making contributions. And once you make a contribution to somebody, you get on their mailing list, and they sell that mailing list. And now you're on 10 different mailing lists. And you make another contribution and you're on 10 more mailing lists. Frankly, the post office would go out of business if it weren't for these people. I would say that probably at least half of the mail, and maybe 3/4 of it, goes to seniors from people soliciting contributions. It's just incredible. So Marcus decides, well, Dad really shouldn't be writing all these checks. Well, Dad still believes he's competent. And he believes he's making the right decision in making these checks. And therefore, that's one of the conflicts. Now, one way we deal with that is we use what can be called an escrow arrangement, which either could be formal or informal. And what we would do is Alexander would sign multiple copies. He certainly wants to keep a copy so he knows what he signed. He might give a copy to Belinda, he might give a copy to Marcus, and he might also give a copy to Teresa. But one of the things he can do is if he's a little concerned about Marcus acting prematurely, what he can do is not give a copy to Marcus. Instead, he might give it to somebody else. He might give it to his next door neighbor. He might give it to his pastor. He might give it to somebody who's familiar with him and with the instructions that if Marcus needs to act, if you think in your opinion that Marcus needs to begin acting for me, then give this power of attorney to him. Marcus can't walk into Wells Fargo and say, I'm Dad's power of attorney, I need $10,000 to pay for his nursing home expenses. They are not going to give him $10,000 just on his word. They're going to want to see the power of attorney. And in most cases, they're also going to know, well, how do we know? Now, that's more likely to occur if you're at a small town bank. But they typically, it's not unusual for us to hear stories about where I was dealing with a client, very intelligent guy, took care of all the business, and the banker, Bank of Botetourt, called me one morning and said, Jim doesn't seem to be, he's acting a little strangely. You know, he came by the bank and asked some questions and stuff, and we're a little concerned about Jim. Well, it wasn't too long, I got a call from his wife. Similar questions. So sometimes your bank will kind of protect you by checking on this as well. But this escrow arrangement is one way that we can try to sort of straddle to or balance two concerns. One concern is, if I truly am incapacitated, I don't want my agent to have to repeatedly show to the financial institutions that I'm incapacitated. We don't want to have Marcus to have to go to the doctor every month and get a letter saying, yeah, Alexander's still incapacitated, so therefore, well, in this case, it would be Teresa, because Teresa's the one that has, she's the agent who is an alternate agent. But we don't want to have her to have to do that. But at the same time, we don't want the agent to be able to just act without somebody saying, hey, it's now time. Now, I could talk for hours about this, because for many people, the power of attorney is more important than the will. Or I'd say the power of attorney and the medical directive. Because many wills are pretty standard. And particularly if you have children, it's usually everything to my spouse and everything in equal shares to my wife. Power of attorney is different, because many cases you'll pick the person that you think is the right person to the exclusion of other persons. And the powers that you give them may differ. And medical directives, sometimes called living wills, are even more specific to the situation and to the family than wills are. So they're very important also. Okay, if we look at this, this draft that I sent you, page 2 is different. If you had a power of attorney signed in Virginia before 2009, you would have not seen this page. This page is incorporating by reference pages upon pages of legal document work provisions. It goes into great detail of what powers the agent has with respect to real property, what powers they have with respect to tangible personal property, what powers they have with respect to stocks and bonds, and on down the list. You can see under insurance and annuities, we've added a parenthetical that says this does not give them the power to change beneficiaries. One of the changes that occurred in 2009, when the legislature changed the law governing powers of attorney, is that you can now give your agent what we would call testamentary powers. In other words, the power to change the way your assets are distributed upon your death. You can actually give that agent the power to change the beneficiary of your life insurance. You can give, there's another one, retirement plans. This does not include the power to change beneficiaries. You can give that person the power to change the beneficiaries. So you might have named all 3 children and they say, well, we want it to go this child. And we've said no. The bigger point is there's this long, this list that incorporates very broad powers under a broad range of topics. Now, because most people haven't memorized those statutes, we begin at the bottom of page 2 and continuing on page 3 with some specific powers. These are the kinds of powers that you would have read in a power of attorney that was done before 2009. On page 4, section 13 is the power to access, use, and take control of my digital devices. And it also addresses digital accounts. This is becoming a major problem. A friend of mine, age 58, had a severe stroke. And he did all of his banking online. There wasn't even any obvious answer of which banks he dealt with, because he didn't get paper statements. You know, if you do online banking, it's important for somebody to know where you do the online banking and what your passwords are and that kind of thing. That's a really big problem. This power of attorney is designed to address that. So that's a new provision that you probably wouldn't have seen in your power of attorney of 10 years ago. One of the problem areas of power of attorney is found in section 4. One of the design decisions you must make when you are having a power of attorney prepared is whether to give your agent the authority to make gifts. And your first impression might be, well, why would I want them to be able to give my property away? Generally speaking, the idea is the agent is supposed to be acting for my benefit, and giving my property away is probably not for my benefit. Well, there are three reasons why you might give them gift authority. One is really almost gone now, and that is we used to include it in there so they could make gifts to save estate taxes. Well, hardly anybody is subject to estate tax anymore. The lifetime exemption is so high that very few people are. So that's no longer really relevant. The second one is some folks have a regular pattern of making gifts. Church, contributions to church, etc., that's considered a gift. And so they want their agent to be able to continue that if they become disabled. The third reason is the most troublesome in a way, and that is, do I want to allow my agent to give away my assets so that I can become eligible for Medicaid? Now, Medicaid is the only government program that pays for long-term care. So if you have to go into a nursing home, the only government program that will pay for that is Medicaid, not Medicare. Medicare will pay up to 100 days of rehabilitative care. But if you're in there for a long period of time, Medicaid is the only one that will pay for that. Medicaid is a welfare program, which means it's for the poor, which means that you have to basically have no assets and no income. Or if you do have income, all the income must be used to be applied to your care. Well, you probably know of people who have given away their assets so that they can become eligible for Medicaid. Happens all the time. There are complicated rules about that, but the power has to be pretty much absolute. In other words, they have to be able to give away everything. Well, the question is, philosophically, do you feel it's appropriate to be making gifts so that your assets are not used for your care anymore, and then the rest of the taxpayers are paying for your care. That's a sort of a philosophical, moral issue. But the other issue is, do I want to give my children the power, or my agent, the power to give away all my assets so that I can do this kind of, so that they can do this planning for me if I become incapacitated? Most people are highly influenced by their lawyer on how they come out with that decision. I have a law partner who believes very much in Medicaid eligibility planning. And so he writes lots of powers of attorney with wide open gift powers. I don't really believe in it. I do some limited things, but I don't really think that's the right thing to do. And so I do very few of those. But you should be aware of the choice, and it's really your choice. It's not your lawyer's choice, as how broad the gift power can be. Now, these gift powers are very limited. It's the power to make gifts to charities or to a trust that I have established. It's gifts to make beneficiaries named in my will in total or partial satisfaction of any bequests. That essentially is sort of enables the agent to make deathbed gifts. To disclaim property, that's very technical. What it means is that you have a husband and wife. Wife dies, leaving everything to the husband. If the husband's incapacitated, it may make sense for the husband to disclaim that property. In other words, refuse to accept it. So then it goes down to the children. And this document allows the agent to do that. Now, if I'd done this well, I would have been giving you opportunities to ask questions all along the way. But our time is kind of limited this morning, and so I've kind of gone through full steam ahead. But if you have questions, I'd be happy to hear that, listen to those.
If you have a power of attorney of just one person, can you add an additional person to that?
You can't amend a power of attorney. So you can do a second power of attorney, or you can do a new power of attorney that names your existing person and one other person. Now, this one says, because we're always a little concerned about this, the last section on this is on page 5, section 9, says, I revoke all powers of attorney I have previously signed, whether they were general, special, or limited. Because we don't want, my client comes in and wants me, and we talk about it, and we decide on how we're going to do this. We don't want some previous power of attorney to sort of upset the plans we've made. So this says that all previous ones are revoked. Now, that language is not really enough. If you have given the power, if you've signed a power of attorney that appoints someone as your agent, and you've given them a copy of it, it's still valid until they know that it's been revoked. So if you want to revoke it, you have to give them notice. You have to send them notice and say, I have revoked the power of attorney that I signed in 2005, and you are no longer my agent. It's sort of an imperfect system, because they could still, if they still have the power of attorney, they can still go to the bank and say, if they're thieving scoundrels, they can still go and say, yeah, here, I need to pull out this money. But legally, they don't have the authority to do that.
Would that be advisable? I mean, you're saying a dual power is best.
Yes, because well, that raises another question. That is, what if I don't have a power of attorney? Well, there is a legal process to have someone appointed by the court in order to handle your affairs if you become incapacitated. and that person is now called a conservator. They, in the past, they had other names, but now it's called a conservator. And the court will appoint that conservator, and they will take control of your property and handle your property for you. That involves a court proceeding to determine whether you're incapacitated. One of the, and they have to appoint a lawyer to represent your interest. One of the goals here, a reason to have a power of attorney, is so you avoid that expense. But it's also a somewhat traumatic situation. You know, if you don't have a power of attorney and you say your children have to file a court action and you have to be served with papers and you have to be interrogated by a lawyer and you may have to be brought into the court hearing, and you're at a time when you're anxious, you know, typically when you are suffering from diminished capacity, one of the things that happens is you become anxious. You know, and you're easily upset by things that you don't understand. And there's a lot of things you learn that you cease to understand well because of your diminished capacity. And so that can be somewhat of a traumatic situation. So one of the reasons that people do powers of attorney is to avoid that kind of a process. A conservator is also under court supervision, which means that they have to file reports with the Commissioner of Accounts. Now, you might say, well, that sounds like a good idea. I'd like somebody looking over the shoulder of this person. But it's usually more hassle than it's worth. There's an expense associated with that accounting.
Are we required to have a medical power of attorney?
No, you don't have to have a medical power of attorney, just as you don't have to have a general power of attorney.
When my husband went into the nursing home, they told us we had to have that. Also, when I first moved to Friendship, we had a panel, hospice, lawyers, etc. And that was one of the things we were told at that time, that we needed to have a medical power of attorney.
Well, I strongly recommend that you have one. But it's not legally required.
Okay.
The medical directive is a topic for another day, and if you're thinking about topics, that's another topic. It doesn't work the way it was intended to work. It's called, in Virginia, the medical power of attorney. We don't really recognize that. What we have is an advanced medical directive. And it incorporates two pieces. One piece is a directive of saying, this is what I want to happen in certain circumstances. I want health care to be withheld or withdrawn if these circumstances exist. The other piece is the appointment of an agent to make healthcare decisions. And that's sometimes called a medical power of attorney, but we do it in one document. If you don't have one, Virginia law does have a statute that designates who can make medical decisions for you. It's your spouse first, your parents next, your children then, and goes on down the line. Of course, all of the institutions, the hospitals, the nursing homes, all those facilities want a medical power of attorney.
Okay.
Or a medical directive. By law, any hospital that receives Medicare payments must ask a patient, do you have one? You don't have to have one, but they have to ask that question. But that's a topic for another day.
Okay. My second question, I did not understand about property when you go on Medicaid. My understanding was if you owned a house and you went on Medicaid, it automatically, within 5 years, it went to pay for your
well,
Medicare.
Medicaid is another topic we could spend an hour or two on. In one sense, if you go into a nurse, if you're married and you have a home and your spouse is living in the home, then the home is not called a countable asset. They don't count it for purposes of determining Medicaid eligibility. But if you're living alone in the home, then it is a countable asset. And you have basically 6 months to sell it if you're in order to be eligible for Medicaid. But there are some strategies to try to avoid that result. But again, that's a topic for another day. Yes, sir.
Going back to your medical power of attorney, if you have a living will, do you need a medical power of attorney also, or do you recommend that?
Well, in some cases, those terms are used interchangeably. So if I ask somebody, do you have a living will, they'll pull out an advanced medical directive, or they'll pull out a medical power of attorney. So a living will is in my view, sort of a poor name, because a will is something that disposes of property at death. But I'm not sure why they came up with that term 30 years ago. The point, the document, whatever you call it, really has two purposes. One purpose is to express your wishes. And you can be fairly specific if you wish. You can be very general if you wish. And it also can appoint an agent, someone who's actually going to make the decision based on what purposes you've expressed in the document. Howard? Yes, sir.
Question on page 2, you talk about the expansion that was made in 2000-something. The power of attorneys that were set up prior to that, is it affected by that, or is this just what we're doing?
The powers of attorney that were signed before the new statute are still valid. You know, there's nothing. The new statute did not say that all old powers of attorney have to be replaced. Right. The statute before was about this long, and now it's about 10 pages. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have another question. This may be a little out of line what you're talking about here, but you got investments in any kind of investment, like bonds, mutual funds, whatever. You can have transfer on death. In other words, what you avoid is probate, right?
Right.
Okay, is that a good idea?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Is that a lawyer answer? You have to be careful when you use transfer on death designations. The actual designation could be very short, but there's a transfer on death agreement, which is actually many pages, you know, 4, 5, 6 pages, that interprets what that means. And so you have to be careful that document that interprets what you put on that TOD designation really does what you want. It's less problem than it used to be, but some of those did not work the way you would expect. Now, if you say I put my 3 children as TOD beneficiaries, and they all were living at your death, then they would divide it equally, and that's what you would expect. But if one of them died before you did, there were some strange results under some TOD agreements. We personally, in our firm, we will use them with a trust, so So if you have a trust agreement, we will use the TOD agreement to say the trust is the beneficiary, because we're confident that the trust will then distribute your property the way you want it to be distributed in a lot of different situations. And if you only have one child, say, and you just want everything to go to that child, well, it's okay in that situation. But anything other than that, it can get, you can have some unexpected consequences to using those.
So in the case that he's talking about, a trust is a much better vehicle for doing what we want to do.
Right. Yeah, we use the TOD designations in conjunction with the trust. The TOD allows us to avoid probate. The trust allows us to make sure the property goes where we want it to go.
Another question. You've got property. You want to leave it to your children, maybe. You can give it to them. If you give it to them, deed it to them or whatever, there is an advantage if you will it to them, because then they can take fair market value. Could you talk about that just a little bit?
Yeah, one of the biggest benefits in all the tax law is the step up in basis that occurs at death. And what that means is that when you sell property, you pay capital gains on the difference between what the selling price is and what your basis is. Now, your basis typically starts out as being what you paid for it. So if you bought a house for $100,000 and it's now worth $300,000, a house isn't exactly the best if you bought it for $100,000, you sell for $300,000, you pay capital gains on $200,000, except for the fact that there's a special rule that applies to principal residence. That special rule doesn't apply to your children. So if you give your property to your children in your will, then the basis of the property becomes the date of death fair market value. So they can then sell the property for no capital gains, no income tax at all. If you have a property that you've rented and you've taken depreciation, all that depreciation gets wiped out. They don't have any depreciation recapture. They don't have any capital gains on the appreciation over what you paid for it. So that step up in basis at death is a very, very valuable tax provision. If you give property away, unless you retain a life estate, they have the same basis that you have. So if you have a office building that you've depreciated and it's worth, you paid $200,000 for it, you've depreciated it down to $50,000, it's now worth $400,000. When you give that $400,000 property to your children, they've got a substantial tax bill coming when they sell that. But if you keep it and own it and give it to them, then they won't have any tax bill at all. The witching hour is about to approach for me. And I would take one more question if there is one.
Okay, I have one more. Contributions to charitable organization. You got an IRA. I think it has to be IRA money. You can, if it comes from an institution to the charitable organization, you get a nice deduction on your income, correct?
Well, what actually happens, there's two ways you can do this. To use your IRA to fund a charitable contribution and save estate income taxes. One is you can just name a charity as your beneficiary at your death, and they will get whatever you, if you just say 10% of this IRA, they'll get 10%, and they don't have to pay tax on it. It's important to remember that if you have an IRA, suppose you have an IRA that's $100,000 IRA. It's not worth $100,000 because in order to spend that IRA, you have to take the money out, and whoever takes that money out, if it's not a charity, is going to pay income tax. So depending on your tax bracket or your children's tax bracket or whoever, that $100,000 IRA may only be worth $70,000. Now, if you have that $100,000 IRA and you pay it to a charity, it's actually worth $100,000 to the charity. That's one situation. The other situation is you can now give up to $100,000 each year by making a transfer from your IRA to the charity. You don't get a deduction for that, but you don't include it in income,
right,
which is actually better than a deduction.
And that can amount to a pretty good amount of money on your taxes.
Right. If you had a $100,000 IRA and you transferred $100,000, that's $30,000 of income tax that somebody isn't going to have to pay. Okay. Thank you for the opportunity.